Alan didn't answer Ace. He spoke to Polly instead, tightening his hands on the Tasty Munch can as he did. Ace hadn't even looked at the can, it seemed, very likely because Alan had made absolutely no attempt to hide it. Annie wasn't wearing her seatbelt that day, Alan said to Polly. Did I ever tell you that? I don't remember, Alan. Behind Ace, Norris Ridgwick was pulling himself laboriously out of the cruiser's window. That's why she went through the windshield. In just a moment, I'm going to have to go for one of them, he thought. Ace or Mr. Gaunt? Which way? Which one? That's what I always wondered about, why her belt wasn't buckled. She didn't even think about it, the habit was so deeply ingrained. But she didn't do it that day. Last chance, cop, Ace shrieked. I'll take my money or this bitch. You choose. Alan went on ignoring him. But on the tape, her belt was still buckled, Alan said, and suddenly he knew. Knowing rose in the middle of his mind like a clear silver column of flame. It was still buckled, and you fucked up, Mr. Gaunt. Alan wheeled toward the tall figure standing beneath the green canopy 8 feet away. He grasped the top of the Tasty Munch can as he took a single large step toward Castle Rock's newest entrepreneur. And before Gaunt could do anything, before his eyes could do more than begin to widen, Alan had spun the lid off Todd's last joke, the one Annie had said to let him have because he would only be young once. The snake sprang out, and this time it was no joke. This time it was real. It was only real for a few seconds, and Alan never knew if anyone else had seen it, but Gaunt did. Of that, he was absolutely sure. It was long, much longer than the crepe paper snake that had flown out a week or so ago when he had removed the can's top in the municipal building parking lot after his long, solitary ride back from Portland. Its skin glowed with a shifting iridescence, and its body was mottled with diamonds of red and black, like the skin of some fabulous rattler. Its jaws opened as it struck the shoulder of Leland Gaunt's broadcloth coat, and Alan squinted against the dazzling chromic gleam of its fangs. He saw the deadly triangular head draw back, then dart down toward Gaunt's neck. He saw Gaunt grab for it and seize it, but before he did, the snake's fangs sank into his flesh, not once, but several times. The triangular head blurred up and down like the bobbin of a sewing machine. Gaunt screamed, although with pain, fury, or both, Alan could not tell, and dropped the valise in order to seize the snake with both hands. Alan saw his chance and leaped forward as Gaunt held the whipping snake away from him, then hurled it to the sidewalk at his booted feet. When it landed, it was again what it had been before, nothing but a cheap novelty, 5 feet of spring wrapped in faded green crepe paper, the sort of trick only a kid like Todd could truly love. And only a creature like Gaunt could truly appreciate. Blood was trickling from Gaunt's neck in tiny threads from 3 pairs of holes. He wiped it away absently with one of his strange, long-fingered hands as he bent to pick up his valise, and stopped suddenly. Bent over like that, long legs cocked, long arm reaching, he looked like a woodcut of Ichabod Crane. But what he was reaching for was no longer there. The hyena hide valise, with its gruesome respiring sides, now sat on the pavement between Alan's feet. He had taken it while Mr. Gaunt had been occupied with the snake, and he had done it with his customary speed and dexterity. There was no doubt about Gaunt's expression now. A thunderous combination of rage, hate, and unbelieving surprise contorted his features. His upper lip curled back like a dog's muzzle, exposing the rows of jostling teeth. Now all those teeth came to points, as if filed for the occasion. He held his splayed hands out and hissed, "Give it to me! It's mine!" Alan didn't know that Leland Gaunt had assured dozens of Castle Rock residents, from Hugh Priest to Slopey Dodd, that he hadn't the slightest interest in human souls, poor, wrinkled, diminished things that they were. If he had known, Alan would have laughed and pointed out that lies were Mr. Gaunt's chief stock in trade. Oh, he knew what was in the bag, all right, what was in there, screaming like power lines in a high wind and breathing like a frightened old man on his deathbed. He knew very well. Mr. Gaunt's lips pulled back from his teeth in a macabre grin. His horrible hands stretched out further toward Alan.
I'm warning you, Sheriff. Don't fuck with me. I'm not a man you want to fuck with. That bag is mine, I say.
I don't think so, Mr. Gaunt. I have an idea that what's in there is stolen property. I think you'd better. Ace had been staring at Gaunt's subtle but steady transformation from businessman to monster, his mouth agape. The arm around Polly's throat had relaxed a little, and she saw her chance. She twisted her head and buried her teeth up to the gum line in Ace Merrill's wrist. Ace shoved her away without thinking, and Polly went sprawling into the street. Ace leveled the gun at her. "Bitch!" he cried. "There," Norris Ridgwick murmured gratefully. He had rested the barrel of his service revolver along one of the flasher bars. Now he held his breath, caught his lower lip in his teeth, and squeezed the trigger. Ace Merrill was suddenly hurled over the woman in the street. It was Polly Chalmers, and Norris had time to think he should have known, with the back of his head spreading and flying outward in clumps and clots. Suddenly, Norris felt very faint, but he also felt very, very blessed. Alan took no notice of Ace Merrill's end. Neither did Leland Gaunt. They faced each other, Gaunt on the sidewalk, Alan standing by his station wagon in the street with the horrible breathing valise between his feet. Gaunt took a deep breath and closed his eyes. Something passed over his face, a kind of shimmer. When he opened his eyes again, a semblance of the Leland Gaunt who had fooled so many people in the Rock was back. Charming, urbane Mr. Gaunt. He glanced down at the paper snake lying on the sidewalk, grimaced with distaste, and kicked it into the gutter. Then he looked back at Alan and held out one hand. "Please, Sheriff, let's not argue. The hour is late and I'm tired. You want me out of your town, and I want to go. I will go as soon as you give me what's mine. And it is mine, I assure you." "Assure and be damned. I don't believe you, my friend." Gaunt stared at Alan with impatience and anger. "That bag and its contents belong to me. Don't you believe in free trade, Sheriff Pangborn? What are you, some sort of communist? I dickered for each and every one of the things in that valise. I got them fair and square. If it's a reward you want, an emolument, a commission, a finder's fee, a dip out of the old gravy boat, whatever you want to call it, that I can understand, and that I will gladly pay. But you must see, this is a business matter, not a legal matter." "You cheated," Polly screamed. "You cheated, and you lied, and you cozened." Gaunt shot her a pained glance, then looked back at Alan. "I didn't, you know. I dealt as I always do. I show people what I have to sell, and let them make up their own minds. So, if you please." "I think I'll keep it," Alan said evenly. A small smile, as thin and sharp as a rind of November ice, touched his mouth. "Let's just call it evidence, okay?" "I'm afraid you can't do that, Sheriff." Gaunt stepped off the sidewalk and into the street. Small red pits of light glowed in his eyes. "You can die, but you can't keep my property. Not if I mean to take it. And I do." He began to walk toward Alan, the red pinpricks in his eyes deepening. He left a boot track in an oatmeal-colored lump of Ace's brains as he came. Alan felt his belly try to fold in on itself, but he didn't move. Instead, prompted by some instinct he made no effort to understand, he put his hands together in front of the station wagon's left headlight. He crossed them, made a bird shape, and began to bend his wrists rapidly back and forth. "The sparrows are flying again, Mr. Gaunt," he thought. A large projected shadow bird, more hawk than sparrow, and unsettlingly realistic for an insubstantial shade, suddenly flapped across the false front of Needful Things. Gaunt saw it from the corner of his eye, whirled toward it, gasped, and retreated again. "Get out of town, my friend," Alan said. He rearranged his hands, and now a large shadow dog, perhaps a St. Bernard, slouched across the front of You So and So in the spotlight thrown by the station wagon's headlights, and somewhere near, perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not, a dog began to bark, a large one by the sound. Gaunt turned in that direction. He was looking slightly harried now and definitely off balance. "You're lucky I'm cutting you loose," Alan went on, "but what would I charge you with, come to that? The theft of souls may be covered in the legal code Brigham and Rose deal with, but I don't think I'd find it in mine. Still, I'd advise you to go while you still can."
"Give me my bag!"
Alan stared at him, trying to look unbelieving and contemptuous while his heart hammered away wildly in his chest. Don't you understand yet? Don't you get it? You lose! Have you forgotten how to deal with that? Gaunt stood looking at Alan for a long second, and then he nodded. I knew I was wise to avoid you, he said. He almost seemed to be speaking to himself. I knew it very well. All right, you win. He began to turn away. Alan relaxed slightly. I'll go. He turned back, quick as a snake himself, so quick he made Alan look slow. His face had changed again. Its human aspect was entirely gone. It was the face of a demon now, with long, deeply scored cheeks and drooping eyes that blazed with orange fire.
But not without my property!
He screamed and leaped for the bag. Somewhere, close by or 1,000 miles away, Polly shrieked, Look out, Alan! But there was no time to look out. The demon, smelling like a mixture of sulfur and fried shoe leather, was upon him. There was only time to act or time to die. Alan passed his right hand down the inside of his left wrist, groping for the tiny elastic loop protruding from his watch band. Part of him was announcing that this would never work. Even another miracle of transmutation couldn't save him this time, because the folding flower trick was used up. It was. His thumb slipped into the loop. The tiny paper packet snapped out. Alan thrust his hand forward, sliding the loop free for the last time as he did so. Abracadabra, you lying fuck, he cried, and what suddenly bloomed in his hand was not a bouquet of flowers, but a blazing bouquet of light that lit Upper Main Street with a fabulous shifting radiance. Yet he realized the colors rising from his fist in an incredible fountain were all one color, as all the colors translated by a glass prism or a rainbow in the air are one color. He felt a jolt of power run up his arm, and for a moment he was filled with a great and incoherent ecstasy. The white! The coming of the white! God howled with pain and rage and fear, but did not back away. Perhaps it was as Alan had suggested. It had been so long since he had lost the game that he had forgotten how. He tried to dive in below the bouquet of light shimmering over Alan's closed hand, and for just a moment his fingers actually touched the handles of the valise between Alan's feet. Suddenly a foot clad in a bedroom slipper appeared, Polly's foot. She stamped down on Gaunt's hand.
Leave it alone, she screamed.
He looked up, snarling, and Alan jammed the fistful of radiance into his face. Mr. Gaunt gave voice to a long, gibbering wail of pain and fear and scrabbled backward with blue fire dancing in his hair. The long white fingers made one final effort to seize the handles of the valise, and this time it was Alan who stamped on them. I'm telling you for the last time to get out, he said in a voice he did not recognize as his own. It was too strong, too sure, too full of power. He understood he probably could not put an end to the thing which crouched before him, with one cringing hand raised to shield its face from the shifting spectrum of light, but he could make it gone. Tonight, that power was his, if he dared use it, if he dared to stand and be true. And I'm telling you for the last time that you're going without this.
They'll die without me,
the gaunt thing moaned. Now its hands hung between its legs. Long claws clicked and clittered in the scattered debris which lay in the street.
Every single one of them will die without me, like plants without water in the desert. Is that what you want? Is it?
Polly was with Alan then, pressed against his side. Yes, she said coldly. Better that they die here and now, if that's what has to happen, than that they go with you and live. We did some lousy things, but that price is much too high. The gaunt thing hissed and shook its claws at them. Alan picked up the bag and backed slowly into the street with Polly by his side. He raised the fountain of light flowers so that they cast an amazing, revolving glow upon Mr. Gaunt and his Tucker talisman. He pulled air into his chest, more air than his body had ever contained before, it seemed. And when he spoke, the words roared from him in a vast voice which was not his own. Go hence, demon! You are cast out from this place! The gaunt thing screamed as if burned by scalding water. The green awning of Needful Things burst into flame, and the show window blew inward, its glass pulverized to diamonds. From above Alan's closed hand, bright rays of radiance, blue, red, green, orange, deep-hued violet, struck out in every direction. For a moment, a tiny exploding star seemed balanced on his fist. The hyena hide valise burst open with a rotted pop, and the trapped, wailing voices escaped in a vapor which was not seen but felt by all of them, Alan, Polly, Norris, Seaton. Polly felt the hot, sinking poison in her arms and chest disappear. The heat slowly gathering around Norris's heart dissipated. All over Castle Rock, guns and clubs were cast down. People looked at each other with the wondering eyes of those who have awakened from a dreadful dream, and the rain stopped. Still screaming, the thing which had been Leland Gaunt hopped and scrambled across the sidewalk to the Tucker. It pulled the door open and flopped behind the wheel. The motor screamed into life. It was not the sound of any engine made by human hands. A long lick of orange fire belched from the exhaust pipe. The taillights flared, and they were not red glass, but ugly little eyes, the eyes of cruel imps. Polly Chalmers screamed and turned her face against Alan's shoulder, but Alan could not look away. Alan was doomed to see and to remember all his life what he saw, as he would remember the night's brighter marvels, the paper snake that became momentarily real, the paper flowers that had turned into a bouquet of light and a reservoir of power. The three headlights blazed on. The Tucker backed out into the street, smoking the macadam beneath its tires to boiling goo. It screamed around in a reverse turn to the right, and although it did not touch Alan's car, the station wagon flew backward several feet just the same, as if repelled by some powerful magnet. The front end of the talisman had begun to glow with a foggy white radiance, and beneath this glow it seemed to be changing and reforming itself. The car shrieked, pointing downhill toward the boiling cauldron which had been the municipal building, the litter of smashed cars and vans, and the roaring stream that no bridge spanned. The engine cranked up to insane revs, souls howling in a discordant frenzy, and the bright, misty glow began to spread backward, engulfing the car. For one single moment, the gaunt thing looked out of the drooping, melting driver's side window at Alan, seeming to mark him forever with its red, lozenge-shaped eyes, and its mouth opened in a yawning snarl. Then the Tucker began to roll. It picked up speed as it went downhill, and the changes picked up speed as well. The car melted, rearranged itself. The roof peeled backward, the shiny hubcaps grew spokes, the tires grew simultaneously higher and thinner. A form began to extrude itself from the remains of the Tucker's grill. It was a black horse with eyes as red as Mr. Gaunt's, a horse encased in a milky shroud of brightness, a horse whose hooves struck up fire from the pavement and left deep, smoking tracks impressed in the center of the street. The talisman had become an open buckboard with a hunchback dwarf sitting up high on the seat. The dwarf's boots were propped on the splashboard, and the calf-curled toes of those boots appeared to be on fire. And still, the changes were not done. As the glowing buckboard raced toward the lower end of Main Street, the sides began to grow. A wooden roof with overhanging eaves knit itself out of that nourishing protein shroud. A window appeared. The spokes of the wheels took on ghostly flashes of color as the wheels themselves and the hooves of the black horse left the pavement. The talisman had become a buckboard. The buckboard now became a medicine show wagon of the sort which might have crisscrossed the country 100 years ago. There was a legend written on the side, and Alan could just make it out. Caveat emptor, it said. 15 feet in the air and still rising, the wagon passed through the flames sprawling out from the ruins of the municipal building. The hooves of the black horse galloped on some invisible road in the sky, still striking off sparks of brilliant blue and orange. It rose over Castle Stream, a glowing box in the sky. It passed over the down bridge, which lay in the torrent like the skeleton of a dinosaur. Then a raft of smoke from the burning hulk of the municipal building blew across Main Street. And when the smoke cleared, Leland Gaunt and his hell wagon were gone. Alan walked Polly down to the cruiser, which had brought Norris and Seaton up street from the municipal building. Norris was still sitting in the window, clinging to the flasher bars. He was too weak to lower himself back inside without falling. Alan slipped his hands around Norris's belly, not that Norris, who was built like a tent peg, had much, and helped him to the ground. Norris? What, Alan? Norris was weeping. From now on, you can change your clothes in the crapper any time you want, Alan said. Okay? Norris did not seem to hear. Alan had felt the blood soaking into his first deputy's shirt. How bad are you hit?
Not too bad. At least, I don't think so. But this...
He swept his hand at the town, encompassing all the burning and all the rubble.
All this is my fault. Mine.
You're wrong, Polly said.
You don't understand.
Norris's face was a twisted rag of grief and shame. I'm the one who slashed Hugh Priest's tires. I set him off. Yes, Polly said. Probably you did. You'll have to live with that. Just as I'm the one who set Ace Merrill off. And I'll have to live with that. She pointed toward where Catholics and Baptists were straggling off in different directions, unhampered by the few dazed cops who were still standing. Some of the religious warriors were walking alone. Some walked together. Father Brigham appeared to be supporting Reverend Rose, and Nan Roberts had her arm around Henry Peyton's waist. But who set them off, Norris, and Wilma, and Nettie, and all the others? All I can say is that if you did it all yourself, you must be a real bear for work. Norris burst into loud, anguished sobs.
I'm just so sorry.
So am I, Polly said quietly. My heart is broken. Alan gave Norris and Polly a brief hug and then leaned in the passenger window of Seat's cruiser. How are you feeling, old buddy?
Pretty perky, Seat said. He looked, in fact, absolutely agog, confused but agog. You folks look lots worse than I do.
Now, I think we better get Norris to the hospital, Seat. If you've got room in there, we could all go.
You bet, Alan. Climb in. Which hospital?
Northern Cumberland, Alan said. There's a little boy there I want to see. I want to make sure his father got to him.
Alan, did I see what I thought I saw? Did that fella's car turn into a wagon and go flying off into the sky?
I don't know, Seat. Alan said, and I'll tell you the God's honest truth. I never want to know. Henry Peyton had just arrived, and now he touched Alan on the shoulder. His eyes were shocked and strange. He had the look of a man who will soon make some big changes in his way of living, his way of thinking, or both. What happened, Alan? He asked. What really happened in this goddamn town? It was Polly who answered. There was a sale, the biggest going-out-of-business sale you ever saw. But in the end, some of us decided not to buy. Alan had opened the door and helped Norris into the front seat. Now he touched Polly's shoulder. Come on, he said. Let's go. Norris is hurting, and he's lost a lot of blood.
Hey, Henry said. I've got a lot of questions, and...
Save them. Alan got back in next to Polly and closed the door. We'll talk tomorrow, but for now, I'm off duty. In fact, I think I'm off duty in this town forever. Be content with this. It's over. Whatever went on in Castle Rock is over.
But...
Alan leaned forward and tapped Seat on one bony shoulder. Let's go, he said quietly, and don't spare the horses. Seat began to drive, heading up Main Street, heading north. The cruiser turned left at the fork and began to climb Castle Hill toward Castle View. As they topped the hill, Alan and Polly turned back together to look at the town, where fire bloomed like rubies. Alan felt sadness and loss and a strange, cheated grief. My town, he thought. It was my town, but not anymore, not ever again. They turned to face forward again at the same instant and ended up looking into each other's eyes instead.
You will never know, she said softly, what really happened to Annie and Todd that day. You will never know.
And no longer want to, Alan Pangborn said. He kissed her cheek gently. That belongs in the darkness. Let the darkness bear it away. They topped the view and picked up Route 119 on the other side, and Castle Rock was gone. The darkness had borne that away, too. You've been here before. Sure you have. sure. I never forget a face. Come on over. Let me shake your hand. Tell you something. I recognized you by the way you walked even before I saw your face good. You couldn't have picked a better day to come back to Junction City, the nicest little town in Iowa, at least on this side of Ames. Go ahead, you can laugh. It was meant as a joke. Can you sit a spell with me? Right here on this bench by the war memorial will be fine. The sun's warm, and from here we can see just about all of downtown. You want to mind the splinters, that's all. This bench has been here since Hector was a pup. Now, look over there. Now, a little to your right. The building where the windows have been soaped over. That used to be Sam Peebles' office. Real estate man, and a damned good one. Then he married Naomi Higgins from down the road in Proverbia, and off they went, just like young folks almost always do these days. That place of his stood empty for over a year. The economy's been rotten out here since all that Mideast business started. But now somebody's finally taken it over. Been lots of talk about it, too, I want to tell you. But you know how it is. In a place like Junction City, where things don't change much from one year to the next, the opening of a new store is big news. Won't be long, either, from the look of things. The last of the workmen packed up their tools and left last Friday. Now, what I think is... Who? Oh, her. Why, that's Irma Skillins. She used to be the principal at Junction City High School. The first woman principal in this part of the state, I heard. She retired 2 years ago, and it seems like she retired from everything else at the same time. Eastern Star, Daughters of the American Revolution, the Junction City Players. She even quit the church choir, I understand. I imagine part of it's the rheumatiz. She's got it awful bad now. See the way she leans on that cane of hers? A person gets like that, I imagine they do just about anything to get a little relief. Look at that. Checking out that new store pretty close, ain't she? Well, why not? She may be old, but she ain't dead, not by a long chalk. Besides, you know what they say. 'Twas curiosity killed the cat, but it was satisfaction that brought him back. Can I read the sign? You bet I can. I got glasses 2 years ago, but they're just for close work. My long vision has never been better. It says, opening soon, on top, and under that, answered prayers, a new kind of store. And the last line, wait a minute, it's a little smaller. The last line says, you won't believe your eyes. I probably will, though. It says in Ecclesiastes that there ain't nothing new under the sun, and I pretty much hold to that. But Irma will be back. If nothing else, I imagine she'll want to get a good look at whoever it was decided to put that bright red awning over Sam Peebles' old office. I might even have a look inside myself. I suppose most everyone in town will, before everything's said and done. Interesting name for a store, ain't it? Answered Prayers. Makes you wonder what's for sale inside. Why, with a name like that, it could be anything. Anything at all.